It's Mark speaking this evening on the maximum minimum model. So, okay, over to you then, Mark.
Okay, please let me know if the sound is dodgy at any point or whatever, echoey or whatever. No slides, unfortunately, or anything else. It's just me. And I just want to encourage any newbies out there who haven't done a talk on Friday night that it's terrifying, but it's a really good opportunity to do some thinking and research. The challenge has been very refreshing. So I can just say it's definitely a bit nerve-wracking when you can't see other people or see their reactions or anything. But anyway, I will move ahead. I'm going to begin the minimum maximum model with a parable. A parable is supposed to teach a moral or a spiritual lesson. Well, I'm going to try and do a political parable. I may be plagiarizing somebody, this may be completely original. I don't know. And it's a political parable, a story about a place called Gotham Barracks. It's a harsh institution where people are kept prisoner after being stolen off the streets and forcibly imprisoned for no good reason other than the work they were told to do in Gotham Barracks, and for which they receive survival rations. And there were many brutal guards with whips and guns. And naturally, in a situation like that, the prisoners organized. They had their committee. They had the ones who did more of the talking and the confrontation. They wanted to be free. Of course, they wanted to be free. They were there for no good reason. But they also wanted thicker blankets, more food, better food, more time in the courtyard for exercise. And it was a brave prisoner who would go before the governor to say that you're keeping us here illegally, let us go. That would get you a beating for sure. But so would saying that the food is rubbish. So would saying that give us better blankets, you're treating us inhumanely, and give us some money for the forced labor. You would get a beating for that too. So to be somebody who would actually confront the governor or the guards on any subject, you had to be brave for that. And if you tried to escape, as some did, as they charged the guns, many of them died. And the place was strongly fortified. And the conditions, the general conditions of work and of the food and of the lack of care and of the beatings, it sapped their strength and demoralized them. But they didn't give up their hope of freedom, and they never, ever fell in love with the place where they were kept prisoner, and every disgusting meal and every indignity reminded them of their situation. But after some time at Gotham Barracks, there was a change of policy at the top. There was a new governor. And it was decided that the prisoners' committee could now see the new governor. He had a different way of managing the prison. Some of the prisoners could be on the prison management board and make a difference to life in the prison. There would be better food. There would be thicker blankets. There would be more exercise outside. To the question, what about our freedom, came the answer from the governor, we can negotiate, but it's bad out there, it's barren, and it's dangerous. This is your home. The prisoner committee members are going to have better cells because they've got to prepare reports and speeches. They've got to do some practical organizing of all the different things that are going to make the prisoners' lives better. And there were changes at Gotham Barracks. If you had to live at Gotham Barracks as a prisoner, you probably would prefer to live in this new time with a new governor. There weren't so many beatings. The work was a little bit more pleasant. They did get paid as well, so they could go to the shop that was set up. And some prisoners began to forget that they weren't free. After all, they could elect committee members now who could represent them to the governor. And they began to wonder if maybe there really was nothing beyond the barren hills that they could see from the compound. And a different kind of demoralization set in. But there was another group of prisoners, rather small in number, who got together and said to their fellow prisoners, "What has happened to us? In the early days, we knew who our enemy was, and we knew that we wanted to be free, and we certainly never intended to give up our freedom for thicker blankets. Dear fellow prisoners, you have become confused. You think that because you've got some concessions, that you're no longer prisoners. The committee has betrayed you. They're collaborating with the management. They've got better conditions. It's time, fellow prisoners, to form another party. Yeah, we admit it. We are happy to get thicker blankets. We're happy that we're not beaten so regularly or shot. But the problem is that those things, those changes, they're now being used to keep us here. And we, this group, we're not going to negotiate anymore. We're going to put on our banner just one demand: freedom. And when we talk to the governor, we're going to confront him, and we're going to remind you all the time that if we all decide to be free, we can be. Because they're not going to just kill us all. They might have done that under the old regime, under the old governor. But there are many more of us than them. And if we want to be free, we can. And this party, which has as its only demand on its banner, this party is going to be called the Freedom Party of Gotham Barracks, the FPGB. Probably you may have guessed at some point, maybe right at the beginning, that I'm talking about the SPGB. Stephen Coleman, in his Socialist Standard series, Against the Left, described the contribution of the SPGB founders like this. The founders of the Socialist Party in June 1904 were former members of the Social Democratic Federation. They had learnt their Marxism from the SDF, which at least paid lip service to the ideas developed by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. The SDF program aimed at, quote, the establishment of a free condition of society with equal social rights for all and the complete emancipation of labor. Stephen Coleman continues, its revolutionary object was subordinated, however, to a program of palliatives, a minimum program. This dual program was the reason for the SDF's failure as a workers' party. Advocacy of social revolution and demands for social reform cannot go hand in hand. The women and men who left the SDF to form the SPGB were the first to learn this lesson. In doing so, they even rejected Marx's lifelong belief that socialists should give their support to certain legislative reform. I think we sometimes underestimate the newness of the position taken by the founders of the party in 1904. And certainly I found that very striking when I was doing my preparation for this talk. I think going back to the Gotham Barracks story, I think the first thing that if we think about that story of Gotham Barracks with the two regimes, the two styles of oppression, it can help us understand how it was possible that the minimum maximum controversy or the conflict between the immediate demands of the prisoners, who of course stand for the working class, and the maximum demand for freedom or emancipation, and by that, of course, I mean the abolition of capitalism and the introduction of socialism, could, in one historical period, under one particular type of regime, an authoritarian regime, a police, a state type regime, that they may not have existed in conflict, or the conflict between them would not have been so apparent. And I'm talking about the kind of language that we find in the Communist Manifesto, which certainly does assume that the working class will be both working on immediate goals and the goal of overthrowing the bourgeoisie. And I think it's because faced with a police state regime, a governor of the prison, with guards who are absolutely committed to 100% rule with no room for freedom of expression, a very small demand can be a challenge to the whole system. And the person making it may make it in full consciousness that he or she is challenging the system. And so the effect on the consciousness of the prisoners, or the consciousness of the oppressed class, the consciousness of the workers, would not be negative. It wouldn't make them think, we can make the situation better. With these changes, we can make this system work for us. In some situations, thinking about the Europe of 1848, you wouldn't have had those illusions. In the Communist Manifesto, we read, now and then, talking about the early development of the workers' movement, the beginning of coming together in trade unions, the various struggles, sometimes burning down factories. Of course, that was misguided. And in the same context, a few lines later on, Marx and Engels write, now and then the workers are victorious, but only for a time. The real fruit of their battles lies not in the immediate result, but in the ever-expanding union of workers. So a small rebellion might actually lead to the development of consciousness, of working class consciousness, whereas in another period, in different historical circumstances, in a different regime, and I'm thinking now of the enlightened governor, apparently, or modern capitalism, this mixing of maximum and minimum could bring such confusion to the minds of the oppressed class, the working class, the prisoners, that it can become a matter of life or death for the working class movement. And so it turned out to be in the 20th century. Think of the situation of the workers' movement in the autocratic Europe of the 1840s compared with, for example, Germany in the 1900s before World War I, whereas Marx had to flee to London. I think the Communist Manifesto wasn't even printed in Germany. I think it was printed in London, but that's just a memory I have. But certainly Marx couldn't work in Germany. Whereas in Germany in the 1900s, before World War I, the Social Democratic Party had over 1 million members, had some 4.5 million voters, had many members of parliament, numerous papers, affiliated social groups. And in an article on Germany, November 1918 by Pix Meat, He says the SPD still talked of and reckoned itself as being a radical socialist party. Though over the years running up to the war, it drifted further and further towards outright reformism, partly because it had become so institutionalized. Running its own papers and allied with unions, it was very much a part of the fabric of society. Despite this, a small section of revolutionary socialists remained within the SPD, typified by Rosa Luxemburg, and who numbered some 3,000 to 4,000. So the revolutionary socialists in the SPD, according to Pixmeet, were actually a very small number of the party, despite the party's own self-perception to a large extent and its reputation. A second thing that the story of Gotham Barracks can give us insight into, and I've already touched upon it a bit, is the crucial role of consciousness, class consciousness. As Rosa Luxemburg put it in 1906, speaking on behalf of the Polish party, the SDKPIL, or the Social Democracy of the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania. By the way, I should say, if you've ever wondered why it's called the Kingdom of Poland, I should just reassure you that there was no Kingdom of Poland at the time. It was the name of that province of the Russian Empire. And certainly the Russian Empire was called the prison house of the nations. And there certainly was, very, very, very little freedom in that context. But speaking in her commentary on the party's program, What Do We Want? In 1906, she said, when social democracy has the majority of the working population behind it in all the major capitalist countries, then capitalism's last hour will have come. So this is the question of consciousness and the consciousness of the need of the working class to no longer be within capitalism, but actually to overthrow capitalism. And just as in the Gotham Barracks story, when the working class decides that it has had enough of capitalism, that will be the last hour of capitalism. And actually, the question of the minimum maximum program, the question of whether reforms should be advocated by the Socialist Party, this is a question fundamentally of consciousness. Now, capitalist democracy gives a chance, makes it possible for the working class to take state power and thus to overthrow capitalism and implement socialism. And so before there was capitalist democracy, a lot of the demands of the Workers' Party were for democracy. But once we have had capitalist democracy, and that was something that was building, but it came in full swing, around 1918. But once we have capitalist democracy, then that capitalist democracy introduces a further block to the development of our movement. Because the problem has become, for the consciousness of the working class, not so much the physical power of the prison, but the power of the prison over people's mind. As Noam Chomsky says, if you lose power to control people by force, you need better indoctrination. I want to look briefly at Rosa Luxemburg's arguments in favor of the Socialist Party advocating reform and how she links this to consciousness. Very famously, at the beginning of her book on reform or revolution, she says, can we counterpose the social revolution, the transformation of the existing order, our final goal, to social reforms? Certainly not. The daily struggle for reforms, for the amelioration of the condition of the workers within the framework of the existing social order, and for democratic institutions, offers to the social democracy the only means of engaging in the proletarian class war and working in the direction of the final goal, the conquest of political power and the suppression of wage labor. Between social reforms and revolution, there exists for the social democracy an indissoluble tie. The struggle for reforms is its means, the social revolution its aim. And later on in that work, I'll just do two more short quotes. She says, trade union and parliamentary activity are important for the socialist movement because such activity prepares the proletariat, that is to say, creates the subjective factor of the socialist transformation. That's the question of class consciousness. As a result, carrying on with the quote, as a result of its trade union and parliamentary struggles, the proletariat, says Rosa Luxemburg, becomes convinced of the impossibility of accomplishing a fundamental social change through such activity and arrives at the understanding that the conquest of power is unavoidable. And I'd like to just repeat that last part of the quote. As a result of its trade union and parliamentary struggles, the proletariat becomes convinced of the impossibility of accomplishing a fundamental social change through such activity and arrives at the understanding that the conquest of power is unavoidable. Now, I would argue that what she says here has some psychological justification. I think it gives us, I think there is an insight here that both she had and Marx had into the fact that class consciousness comes or can come in many cases gradually. This is not about justifying the reform element of her statement, but it's about recognizing that how people develop politically. Now, in general, I think we would agree that if somebody wants to make, for example, an improvement in their life, and if one person says to them, well, the only way you can improve your life is to leave, for example, London and go over there to New Zealand, and you'd better do it tomorrow. And someone else says, well, that might work. On the other hand, you might want to, take up yoga, stay in London, and eat a bit better and maybe, improve one or two things. Now, probably most of us would say, okay, well, I'll go with the small things first, see if that maybe works for me, and then I'll go for the bigger thing. I think it might be possible to sort of universalize that most people are not dying to completely transform everything. And I think although we, each of us has gone down a certain road and we are convinced of the case for socialism, when it may be that, I think it's the case that there has to be a process through which people go. And it's quite possible that that will include many dead ends, many learning by trial and error. That doesn't mean the party needs to take them on that route. But I do think that the thing that we could take from what Rosa Luxemburg has said is possibly that the party should in some way not turn away from them on that route. More of that later. Certainly we can say about Rosa Luxemburg that we want the same thing as she did. I won't say any more than that. Maybe someone wants to discuss that, but that's my strong conviction that we both have the same goal as Rosa Luxemburg and other socialists like her. We disagree on the way to get to that goal. And to be clear, in her book Reform or Revolution, which was written at the turn of the century, she isn't arguing against the SPGB position, but she's arguing against real reformism. What I want to call real reformism, which says that capitalism can be slowly reformed by the working class into socialism, or into a socialized form of society that would deal with the problems that capitalism throws up. That's basically Bernstein's approach. And of course, in later social democracy, especially after the First World War and then the Second World War, actually just let's drop socialism altogether as a goal, and we'll just keep with the reforms of capitalism, and capitalism can be made to be a good system. Now, part of my announced mission today was to talk about how we can counteract the allure of the minimum, maximum, or the reformism, and the people wanting to go down the route of reforms. Well, I think one of the ways is to distinguish how we interact with people. For example, I think when we talk to someone like Rosa Luxemburg, we're going to talk differently to her than we would to an opportunist. She is defending revolution. We just disagree with her approach. It's a serious issue because obviously what happens as a result, which direction the workers' movement goes, is serious. But it's a comradely. It's a discussion between comrades. I was very pleased when I found on the I think it may have been actually on the blog archive of the Socialist Standard. I found a statement from 1969 to a conference of German workers in Augsburg. And it was very interesting. And if any comrades know about this particular conference and our intervention there, I would love to know it. And in this statement made by the SPGB to this conference of German workers in Augsburg, Germany, they said, "We are not saying that all reforms are working class." I'm picking out just a little section. "But that for a socialist party to advocate reforms would be its first step towards becoming a reformist party." This is one of the important points on which we disagree with Rosa Luxemburg. In her Reform or Revolution, she presents a good case against reformism, but still argues that socialists should advocate reforms on the ground that socialist understanding will grow out of the struggle for reform. We submit that experience has proved her wrong. It does not matter why or how reforms are advocated. The reason that the result is the same. Confusion of working class thought rather than growth of socialist understanding. I think that's a great way of speaking to Rosa Luxemburg and a great way of speaking to people like Rosa Luxemburg. To be honest with you, I would rather have Rosa Luxemburg's position. I mean, I would rather be standing on Rosa Luxemburg's position this evening. One, because I would definitely be able to say I'm speaking the same type of language as Marx and Engels, as the social democracy of the day. The question really is, has their position proved itself? Now, of course, it would be easy to come back to us and say, "Yeah, well, you know, your method hasn't worked very well." I think that would be unfair, because I think it was a tragedy, really. Among other things, the Bolshevik Revolution managed to derail the development of the socialist movement. Managed to put the discussion in the socialist movement on the subject of dictatorship versus democracy, which is really a non-subject for socialists. We socialists believe, as Rosa Luxemburg said, in a majority working class government that then brings in a socialist system that then, of course, works for the whole of society with class. Here, there is no the discussion about Bolshevism is not a red herring, because it's really true, but in Marxist theory it's a total red herring. And what would have happened if the First World War had ended with the demonstration of the total corruption of the Social Democratic, the Second International? And would it have been possible in that context, if there had been no debate over Bolshevism, to begin the debate over what is socialism for today, not in the days of the Communist Manifesto and in the days of autocracy, but today in the days when capitalism has now taken full power, both economically and politically, in society, and that we would have been able to advance our position that the time for reforms, the immediate reforms, if we even want to say they were ever okay, the time for reforms has gone, because you have shown it, the social. So going to the role of the party and going back to my, it's terrible, going back to my parable, going back to the prison, how should the Freedom Party of Gotham Barracks engage with the other prisoners? And I think we would agree, certainly not by isolation, by indifference to the small and great outrages and indignities they suffer, but rather standing with the fellow prisoners whenever we as a party, and I'm talking about, of course, the Gotham Barracks Party, whenever we find someone who wants to fight the system, it might be misdirected. They may be channeled away by the circumstances, by other people, from freedom to blankets. But maybe there's a fighter there who may come to the point through a process where we haven't abandoned them, where they realize that they've got to face reality. And it seems to me that the spirit of the Communist Manifesto is to engage in all aspects of the struggle of our class, even if we disagree with the demands that are being made. If actually the struggles represent real working class rebellion against oppression. And I quoted from the last section of the Communist Manifesto, where Marx and Engels write, the communists fight for the attainment of the immediate aims, for the enforcement of the momentary interests of the working class. But in the movement of the present, they also represent and take care of the future of that movement. Now, this is a historical document. Our party has an analysis of why some of the demands, why some of the statements in the Communist Manifesto are not still relevant. But I think what is still relevant is this aspect of taking care, representing and taking care of the future of the working class movement. Another part, right towards the end. In short, the communists everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things. It's not clear that Marx and Engels were as broad as that, but certainly that's a very broad statement. They support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things. In all these movements, they bring to the front as the leading question in each, the property question, private property and the means of production, capitalism, no matter what its degree of development at the time. That spirit of the Communist Manifesto, the breadth of the spirit of it, I think can be maintained even when we reject the minimum program, which was part of the vehicle for the engagement of the Social Democratic parties and even Marx and Engels in the working class struggles. And then I want to commend an article to you, and it's the first article that I've seen in the Socialist Standard that is somewhat critical of the party. But I think it could be could provoke some good discussion. And it was probably, older party members will know what I'm talking about already. It was a talk given by Peter Lawrence in February 2004 at the Central London branch and then was published as an article. And the name of that article was Criticism, Alienation and Engagement. And for our purpose this evening, I want to summarize it just in this way, that it was an attempt by Peter Lawrence to give a periodization of the history of our party. So putting our party into certain periods, a period that was criticism, a period that was alienation, and a period that was engagement, and a period that he's calling for, that he's calling engagement. And I'm quoting from him now. He says, "We enter a period in 1904 when socialist criticism is not just an analysis of the economic development of the capitalist system. It is also a criticism of the political activities of the overwhelming majority of workers in their pursuit of reforms and the various policies which were mistakenly believed to be in the direction of socialism. Inevitably, this resulted, for all practical purposes, in a dissociation or alienation of the Socialist Party from the working class movement." And that paragraph hit me right between the eyes, because coupled with the earlier material about how the SPGB was the first to actually see this problem of the minimum program, the Socialist Party was relatively small, and although it did go over to the Second International to one of the meetings, maybe the inaugural meeting, when it realized what was happening in the Second International and the parties of the Second International, the mass party, especially Germany as a mass party, they realized that they would be swamped in that. And so they stood apart to, in fact, tell the socialist movement, "You are on the wrong road. You think you're on the right road. You think you're stepping in the footsteps of Marx and Engels. But you're actually on the wrong road in this period." And I think one of the great tragedies of the Bolshevik Revolution for socialism is not perhaps just many of the obvious tragedies that we know about, but it's that the discussion within the socialism was derailed onto the subject of dictatorship or democracy, which from a socialist point of view is a non-subject. There are no serious socialists in our socialist history who actually did not advocate a majority working class takeover of power. And the idea that we have to actually discuss whether vanguardism is legitimate. And not only is it, you know, is it, for many reasons it's bad, but one of the reasons is that we're not discussing the actual issue of the minimum program, the reformism of the Social Democratic Party. Can you imagine if there'd been no Bolshevik Revolution? Could it have been that with the abject failure of reformism or the Social Democratic Party's reformism, Rosa Luxemburg doesn't get murdered, but she actually is able to reorientate? I'm just fantasizing a bit, but if our arguments are right, then it may have been that the discussion within the socialist movement would have looked different. But as it were, we were isolated. And as Peter Lawrence argued, that led to an alienation of the Socialist Party from the working class movement that we have become used to, he argued. And he says, "As a party, we tend to be hostile to the activities of all non-socialists. This has a simple logic. One way or another, non-socialists are supporters of capitalism. We are opposed to capitalism. Therefore, we are opposed to the activities of non-socialists." In the past, this was often spat out with total conviction, not to say a certain venom. And for many members, this has been the last socialist word on the subject. But is it? Asks Peter Lawrence in 2004. I think not. And then he goes on to make some suggestions, including how we could interact with Oxfam workers on the basis of showing how their concerns would be met within a socialist society. And then he says, "We must make every attempt to be more positively engaged." And I think that word is important. The title of his talk was criticism, alienation, and engagement. How we can be engaged with the many non-socialists with whom we share common ground of concern and indignation, and the need to establish a world of equality, democracy, and cooperation. So I want to end with these two questions, and that is, how can we engage with socialists who are like Rosa Luxemburg? And I think there may well be many more of them than we know. I speak to you this evening from Poland, and I would do the same on every evening. I speak to you from Poland. When I, in the early 2000s, began looking for involvement in socialism, and I read the Communist Manifesto and things like that, I only could come across liberals, total liberals, total reformists like the Labour Party types, and parties which were Trotskyist. And I know that among the people I was dealing with, we believed in socialism, but we just thought that we had to be involved in all these, struggles of the working class. And, of course, it wasn't of the same quality as Rosa Luxemburg, but I'm just saying that there wasn't anywhere else for me to go, frankly. And one of my, I feel quite sad about Germany, that we don't have a party in Germany. It's a terrible thing. And I can't believe that there are no socialists in Germany who, I'll leave that at that. How can we engage with socialists who are like Rosa Luxemburg? In other words, as from our perspective, confused but sincere revolutionary. And secondly, how can we engage with non-socialist movements that represent real working class struggle? As the Communist Manifesto says, the history of all societies is the history of class struggle. We don't create class. Class struggles occur because of the objective situation of the society. And it was clear that the writers of the Communist Manifesto believed in intervening in those. How can we engage with struggles or movements that represent real working class struggle, even though they may well have very wrong ideas? Thank you.